Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College online journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Greetings and welcome to the War Room podcast. I'm Jacqueline Witt, professor of strategy and the War Room podcast editor, and today's program takes a closer look at the events surrounding the coup in Zimbabwe late last year, and then pivots to thinking about Zimbabwe's future. In mid-November 2017, news started trickling out of Zimbabwe, and elements of the Zimbabwe Defense Forces seized control of Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation in Harare and announced that it was not in fact a coup, but that President Robert Mugabe was under house arrest and that the situation would return to, quote, normal, when criminal elements of Mugabe's government had been appropriately dealt with. So these developments occurred in the midst of rising tensions over who would succeed Mugabe, with factions forming within the ruling party to support either Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa, who is backed by the ZDF, or First Lady Grace Mugabe. After a series of political maneuvers and negotiations, then, Mugabe eventually resigned the presidency and Mnangagwa was sworn in as president on November 24th of last year. And so to shed some light on these events, that's just the sort of rundown of the chronology. To shed some light on these events and to talk about prospects for a post-Mugabe Zimbabwe, I'm here in the studio today with Colonel Chris Wyatt, who is the Director of African Studies at the U.S. Army War College, and who has spent much of his career as an Africa FAO with recent assignments in Ethiopia, Uganda, Mauritania, and Niger. So thanks for being here today, Chris.
Well, Dr. Witt, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to come in and talk about these events.
Absolutely. So with that sort of background that I just gave, can you tell us a little bit more about the history of Zimbabwe and Mugabe's government in particular? And what were some of the challenges that seemed to sort of come to a head and boiled over then in late 2017?
It's a quite long and complicated history. I'll try to give a quick whirlwind tour of it. There was, of course, a colonial period during which a racist regime in what was known as Rhodesia at the time did what they called unilateral declaration of independence in 1965 and broke away from the United Kingdom and sought their own government, which was a minority government. There was a liberation struggle that took place from then until 1979. During which the British government brokered the Lancaster House Agreement, which brought all parties to the table and ended the war. And there were two competing liberation factions, one known as ZANU and the other as ZAPU. Mugabe was the leader of the ZANU group, and Joshua Nkomo was the leader of ZAPU. After the elections, ZANU decisively won the elections, and Mugabe came into office as the prime minister in 1980. He served in that role until 1987. There, part of the agreement, there was an agreement on the settlement of restoration of land rights, land tenure, and there was also an agreement by the British to pay for some of that. And then additionally, there was an agreement on initially for a period of 8 years, a reserved number of seats in the parliament of the 80 seats, 20 for the minority white population. After that, it was an open democracy. And so the constitution was amended in 1988. Mugabe went from being prime minister, was elected as president, and served until recently deposed.
Okay, great. So he's served that's a long time. That's
37
basically
years.
The whole history of Zimbabwe since independence. So what was happening? So Mugabe, how old is he?
93.
Okay, so just given what we know about human lifespans, right, there was going to have to be a succession plan at some point in the near future. Was that the cause of this most recent crisis?
In fact, the whole situation in Zimbabwe is quite complicated, but I would say, in fact, the approximate cause of recent events and Mugabe being deposed are, in fact, tied to the struggle to replace him. He's never made a clear successor. There's been a succession of people who've been in that position. In 2011, his vice president Joyce Mujuru was displaced. Her husband died in mysterious circumstances in a house fire. He was the former military commander and Liberation War hero. He died, and he had a strong support base in the security services. His wife, the vice president, within 2 years was deposed and removed from office and founded her own political party. When she was removed, Emmerson Mnangagwa, the current president, was elevated and became the vice president. And recently, the struggle has moved to there were three factions, the Mujuru faction with Joyce Mujuru, mm-hmm. and they were eliminated from any power base in 2013, 2014 timeframe. The Mnangagwa base, what has become known as Team Lacoste, because Managua's age-old nickname is the Crocodile.
Okay.
And so the Lacoste clothing company, their symbol is the Crocodile. So he's known as the Crocodile. So there was the Mujuru faction, the Mnangagwa faction, and there's a third faction that developed when President Mugabe's current wife, Grace, who was his former secretary, developed political ambitions of her own, and he was moving towards making her his successor informally. She'd been appointed to key positions within the political party, ZANU, and it was being positioned so that she could succeed Mugabe in elections this year, 2018.
So if that's the proximate cause, basically a succession crisis, what were there underlying causes? Were there things in Zimbabwe where people were unhappy? Are there internal political divisions or things that the government needed to address that it simply wasn't addressing?
We should probably go back to when Mugabe first came to power in 1980, and he inherited the country and became the political leader's prime minister. At that time, the ZANU-PF party that took over at the time, inherited a functioning bureaucracy that was run by the racist minority white government, and they also inherited a reasonably well-functioning primary and secondary school education system and a less efficient health system. The ZANU-PF, throughout the first 10 or 15 years of their governance, did a remarkable job extending primary and secondary education and even improving universities and giving access to all Zimbabweans, improving the healthcare sector. So conditions for Zimbabweans dramatically improved at the end of the Civil War, in part because the war ended. There was no longer conflict. But also there was reasonably good governance. There were some back steps. In fact, there was a campaign which wound up eliminating the opposition ZAPU Party, and some massacres that took place from 83 to 87. But by and large, the country was governed reasonably well, and Zimbabwe was a net exporter of farm products, particularly maize and corn. And people's lives were improving. But there was a fair amount of corruption taking place, and as the British became frustrated with the money they were giving to purchase land, which wasn't being purchased for poor farmers or war veterans, it was being given to party officials, the farms that were purchased, they stopped that funding. They suspended that in the early 1990s. That plus the global downturn around 1990 with Saddam Hussein's invasion and the global recession that followed contributed some bad loans by the Zimbabwe government, a few missteps. The economy struggled. As the economy struggled and more money was pilfered out of it by corrupt officials, it became more challenging and people started to lose their condition. So the economic condition became more grave. And about 2000, the farm invasions and seizures started. It was a tactic by Mugabe's government meant to appease his followers. And in essence, what it did is over the course of 2 or 3 years, virtually destroyed Zimbabwe's economy. Its gross domestic product was reduced by over 60%.
Okay, so there's governance issues that evolve over a long period of time, and then this succession crisis. So as the news is coming out and on Twitter, which Twitter's a whole other thing,
it's a force of its own.
It is a force of its own. But I recall very distinctly how conflictual the reports coming out of Zimbabwe were. So if you were following indigenous Zimbabwean sources, if you were following sort of Africa hands, if you were like depending on who you were listening to, there was all sorts of uncertainty. And it took a really long time for us to even decide that this was in fact a coup. Is that the right word for what happened in Zimbabwe?
Well, I would say, in fact, it was a coup. If you read Zimbabwe's constitution, there's no provision that allows for the military to simply arrest the president, detain the president, and determine who is being malfeasant. That's the role of the justice system and the police. They were not doing that. But the power brokers in Zimbabwe, since the outset, have been liberation veterans, those who served in the struggle. Mugabe was one of those, but he was largely a political figure. He didn't serve in the bush. So the security apparatus, not just the military, but also the police and the Central Intelligence Organization, the National Intelligence Organization, the CIO, have always been the guarantor of the party and backing of the party. And so when those folks felt threatened, and most of them backed the current president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, in the succession struggle, when he was marginalized and then booted from the party at the beginning of November and fled to South Africa, they took no action initially. But shortly after that, Grace Mugabe's faction, that's the third faction I had mentioned, the nickname for their faction is not Team Lacoste, that was Mnangagwa, but they're called G40, largely because many of their members are around the age of 40 or younger, which is a rather significant break with the Liberation Era veterans who are all in their 70s, 80s, and 90s now. So what happened there is that after Mnangagwa was kicked out of the party and fled to South Africa, and he was the sitting vice president.
Right.
He was fled to South Africa at the time. What happened is Grace Mugabe, feeling a little more empowered, that she had eliminated her most powerful opponent. Her faction, G40, announced at the party meeting that they were kicking out about 100 members who all happened to be Team Managagua, and they were Team Lacoste. They were kicking them out of the party, and then they were going to look at them for corruption. So it became apparent to the elites and the security apparatus that Liberation Era veterans and the Managagua faction was being eliminated politically. And only at that point did they actually intervene. But yes, in fact, okay. It was a coup. It wasn't a legal action. It was extra-legal activity by the military.
By the military to affect the governance and the government of a country. Why do you think there was hesitance to call it a coup then?
Well, that's a good question. Part of it is appearances. Part of it also was to maintain calm. This coup, I call it the curious case of the coup that wasn't a coup. I actually, on the 15th of November, within 18 hours of it occurring, I actually wrote something and published it online that it was a coup, in fact, a coup. There's a hesitancy for it to be a coup because it's unseemly. The military in Zimbabwe considers itself to be professional. That was part of it. It also puts the Southern African Development Community and South Africa and its neighbors in a very awkward position. And it puts the African Union in a very awkward position. Because at the end of the day, most reasonable people you talk to, whether they're Zimbabweans in Zimbabwe or part of the diaspora in South Africa, the United Kingdom, or the United States, or analysts abroad, many are largely happy with the outcome that Mugabe has left office. And many of the at least public pronouncements of policy by the current president have given hope that there's change for the future.
So this is an interesting tension, right? Because coups within the world of professional militaries, within what we like to think of as normal civil-military relations, coups are a bad thing, right? These are things we want to avoid. And yet, maybe the outcomes, is what you're saying, are perhaps even desirable within the region, within the international community, given some of that. So I can see where that tension comes. Now that you mentioned the current state, so the current president, Mnangagwa, has been sworn in. You said some of his statements have given sort of hope for the future. What do you think are the primary challenges that his government faces in moving forward?
Before I answer, I may, to go back to the last point, what I'm saying is that many people felt a sense of relief over accepted the coup because it was an outcome that they were comfortable with and there was no loss of life. I myself am not endorsing it, and I'm not making a big point about this, but it is a very difficult situation. You know, for decades and decades, since Ataturk's time, the Turkish military was the guarantor of the Turkish secular state, and that has changed recently. They're no longer there. Many people accepted that as the norm. That doesn't necessarily make it right, but it was an outcome many people accepted. In this case, in Zimbabwe, many people realize it's inappropriate, it's extra-legal. Military shouldn't be doing this, but it was a bloodless coup, and political calm has been restored, and so many people accepted it.
Do you think was there a chance that a succession, say Mugabe, say died or something, was there a chance that a succession fight could have actually been between the G40 faction and the Lacoste, Team Lacoste? Could that have actually been more contentious than what ended up happening?
In fact, for the past 17 years or so since the farm invasions took place, I've been talking to folks and warning about a succession crisis for Zanu, because it's clear that Mugabe was not going to leave office. In part, I've always stated that my concern was that he feared prosecution for the massacres in 1983 to 87 in what is known as Matabeleland, when they merged the two political parties and eliminated the opposition. There are tens of thousands of bodies buried in graves there, and people know where they're at. And so I suspect that was the reason he never wanted to leave power. In fact, I've been saying this for about 17 years, if Mugabe had died in office, I've always said that the knives would have come out. There would have been internal struggles within the party. There would have been a number of mysterious traffic accidents, which are common when political figures disappear. And there probably would have been many assassinations, and there would have been very serious bloodletting amongst followers. It might not have affected most of the broader population, but it certainly would have affected the political elites. And you saw this play out with these three factions. When Joyce Majuru was there, Mnangagwa, who's been in government for 37 years as well. He's been minister of many different things, minister of defense, minister of internal security. He's done many different things. So he's never left. He's been a parliamentarian or a minister his entire 37 years, or vice president. So Mnangagwa, when he rose to vice president, it was clear to people that the Majuru faction had been eliminated. And the reason that Joyce Majuru was there, in part, she's an effective parliamentarian, but also her husband, Salim Majuru, who had a huge support base in the security services based on his wartime experience and his service as chief of the military. So that faction was eliminated in Mnangagwa. That was the previous struggle.
Right.
It was a quiet struggle, but it was a question who's going to succeed. When Joyce was sidelined in 2013, 2014 timeframe, Mnangagwa is elevated. At some point, Grace either got some ambition or Robert decided he wanted to have a family tradition continue. Mm-hmm. And then the G40 faction started to gain traction. And those two, without doubt, would have struggled and it would have been very dangerous. One point to note is that in August at a local fair, Mnangagwa became ill after eating some ice cream, and he accused the opposition of trying to poison and assassinate him, and he went to South Africa for treatment. So this, in fact, probably would have played out in very bloody fashion. So a lot of people are relieved and accept this coup, even though they don't call it a coup,
right,
because they're happy that that didn't happen.
Okay. So that I think that, that helps contextualize some of this. But with this new, again, with this new government now, we've discussed the historical challenges, corruption, the economy, development, good governance, and internal political fighting too. Are those the primary challenges facing Mnangagwa and the new government?
Well, in fact, yeah, I don't think that Mnangagwa is going to suffer much in the way of competition within ZANU-PF. If you look at what has happened to the G40 members that are supporters of Grace Mugabe and remaining supporters, loyalists of Robert Mugabe, they've either been sidelined very quickly, replaced in government, or arrested and are facing corruption or criminal charges, including the former vice president, and the list goes on and on and on. In addition to that, he elevated Chiwenga, the general who initiated the coup, to be his vice president. And so he's also brought several former generals who suddenly retired and have now entered government as members of the government. So that is a clear sign that he's been consolidating his position. He's also made announcements, as well as his finance minister, that land that had been confiscated or illegally taken from commercial farmers would be returned. And that's a very nebulous and gray area, and that itself will create a lot of problems. But in a very big sign of fanfare, Darren Smart, a 71-year-old commercial farmer, received his farm back to him, the Lesbury farm. But the thing about that is that that knocked out several birds with one stone. And not only did it give credence that, that there's a change in Zimbabwe and we're going to go back to the rule of law, which the government arguably have abrogated for the last two decades, but the land would also be returned to farmers, it also eliminated a rival. The person who took possession of the farm was a Mugabe supporter and loyalist. And so now he's had the farm taken from him, and so he's eliminated a power base for an opponent and fulfilled a promise he made. So I suspect we'll see a lot of that. The challenge will come is if there are, in fact, free and fair elections this coming summer or winter in southern Africa, but summer for us here in the Northern Hemisphere. So by the end of July or September at the latest, they must hold national elections, and Mnangagwa will most likely run for president. And the question is, will he get reelected? Honestly, if there were free and fair elections and people looked at things objectively, I seriously doubt that ZANU-PF would win re-election. They actually lost the elections in 2008, despite stuffing the ballot boxes and intimidating and murdering opposition politicians in a campaign of violence, which was orchestrated by Emmerson Mnangagwa and supported by the military. And also in 2000, they nearly lost the election in a popular vote. And despite a lot of corruption in that election, they still nearly lost the election.
And this is to an opposition party?
To the opposition party. There is there had not been an opposition party since ZAPU was eliminated and merged with ZANU. And that's how we get the name ZANU-PF, which is the Zimbabwean African National Union Patriotic Front. That was the merger of those two Liberation Era parties after the end of the massacres around 1987 and the new government's formed. So from 87 onwards, there was only one political party in Zimbabwe. Until the late 1990s, under pressure from the World Bank and the Southern African Development Community and neighboring states, Mugabe allowed opposition to form.
Right.
And
okay.
The Movement for Democratic Change was founded based on the trade unions. And so it had a strong urban support base in the capital and other cities. And the leader of that party was Morgan Tsvangirai, who eventually became prime minister in a compromise agreement after the 2008 election to stop violence.
Okay.
So there is an opposition party, and they nearly won the election. And honestly, they probably genuinely won it in 2008, but it was stolen from them.
Okay. So there is political opposition within Zimbabwe. So some democratic sort of mechanisms and organizations are obviously there. What do you think are the broader implications of the coup and the change in government for, we've talked a lot about the sort of domestic environment, but for the regional security environment and for relations with the U.S., what does all of this mean?
Well, I would say that President Mnangagwa has been saying all the right things. And some of the actions so far have confirmed that, in fact, there is change. But from my perspective, I'm not from Missouri, as they say in Missouri, you have to show me. I have to see this. ZANU-PF has a long history of making promises and then breaking the promises and looking the other way. And Mnangagwa, as I've stated, has been a member of this government for 37 years. If, in fact, he wants a genuine legacy of someone who's restored Zimbabwe to great prominence, he has an opportunity here. But I would say they have to show us. A lot of the right steps have been taken, though. Some of the things we haven't discussed is in 2009, they passed what was known as the Indigenization Law. And that law required any foreign direct investment that came into Zimbabwe, any venture that was formed or any company that was already there, the foreign owners had to divest 51% of the shares of that corporation or business to black Zimbabweans. Not to Zimbabweans, but to black Zimbabweans. And that law pretty much dried up foreign direct investment almost overnight. Now, that law is in the process of being rescinded. They said they're not going to follow it anymore, with the exception of Zimbabwe's diamond mines, which is a rather contentious issue on its own. But the removal of that law allows people to go in there and invest. There's another thing that's here that comes to mind is that there's this argument that Zimbabwe's economy was destroyed not by malfeasance or misgoverning, but because of sanctions from the West. The United States has had sanctions or travel restrictions on as many as 168 members of the government and government enterprises run by government officials. But we've never had sanctions on the Zimbabwean people. You and I could have went there and started a business and worked with Zimbabweans without any concern about being sanctioned for that because there's no restriction on that. So I think that going forward, as long as, at least up until the elections this coming 6 months or 8 months or so, as long as that time frame, up to that time frame, I expect that relations will improve between Zimbabwe and the United States and South Africa. And there's already clear signs that the very tense relations with its neighbor Botswana have already started to improve. President Khama has been a long, outspoken critic of Mugabe and called for him to leave office for his entire time. He's been in office as the president of Botswana for the last 10 years. Khama leaves office this year, and his successor will come in. So some of that tension will go away just as a function of that. But also Mnangagwa is reaching out now to Botswana, and that should improve relations and steady security. There are about 2.5 million to 3 million Zimbabweans living in South Africa. What happens with those folks from the diaspora, whether they come back and what contributions they make, could have a significant impact on what happens in Zimbabwe. But there is, I think there's a lot of hope. There's a lot of opportunity here. The removal of the indigenization law, potential return to some farms, the following the rule of law, there is potential. But between now and the elections, I expect to see Mnangagwa consolidate his power base and try to fulfill some of his promises.
Yeah, so lots to keep an eye on, lots to anticipate. And I think you've given us some great things to look for and to look at. So with that, we'll wrap up. Thanks again for joining me today, and thanks for your insights.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I appreciate being here and opportunity to talk about Zimbabwe. Fascinating place, wonderful people, a country with great promise, and likely back on the right track. Thank you.
Great. So we're signing off from the War Room. We'll see you next time.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.